Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 36 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, May 25th, 2019. In the art house, I chat with a mermaid. Well, someone who plays a mermaid on stage and at the beach. For the puzzler question, I ask climate advocates why they choose to do advocacy over protesting. And speaking of advocates, I have two guests with me who are passionate climate change advocates. Earlier in life, they both experienced extraordinary successes in lobbying their governments about other issues. They come to the climate movement with essential strategies and insights that will help you with your own climate work. Meet Sam Daly Harris. Sam grew up in tropical Miami, Florida. Today, he experiences winter and the other seasons in Princeton, New Jersey.
I miss the weather. That's all there is to it. You know, there are people who love seasons, and I get that, but I love green all the time.
In 1995, Sam Daly Harris joined forces with Nobel Peace Prize laureate Muhammad Yunus and with John Hatch, the founder of Finca, an international microloan nonprofit. Together, they co-founded the Microcredit Summit. They reached over 100 million of the world's poorest families with microloans. In 2012, Sam founded the organization that became Civic Courage. He also coached Citizens Climate Lobby for its first 7 years. Today, Sam Daly Harris is in high demand as a speaker and a writer. He recently released the 20th anniversary edition of his book, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Sam's advocacy work, though, started almost 40 years ago. In 1980, Sam founded the grassroots organization called Results. Through Results, Sam Daly Harris helped develop a model of advocacy that empowered citizens to connect directly with lawmakers. Results centered on a big issue: world hunger. And they experienced big successes. At a Citizens Climate regional conference in Troy, New York, I heard Sam speak about the phenomenal success of Results.
So Results started lobbying in the early 80s on child survival. And UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, was reporting in the early 80s that 41,000 children around the world under five were dying every day from mostly preventable malnutrition and disease. Measles coupled with malnutrition. Measles is back in the news a bit. All these preventable diseases coupled with malnutrition. And Results volunteers lobbied every year. Not for the whole year, just usually a three-month period, 84, 85, 86, 97, 90, every year. The latest report from UNICEF is that the 41,000 child deaths a day have dropped to 15,300. 6 years ago, in a New York Times article that also talked about CCL, Kul Gautam, a former deputy executive director of UNICEF, said, to a great extent, it's because of the receptivity created by Results that U.S. funding for child survival increased so dramatically, and that led many other countries to come on board.
Sam has an uncanny sense for what can work in a political world that seems completely dysfunctional. His university studies helped him a lot. No, he did not major in political science or public policy. Sam studied music and began his career as a musician.
That's right. I played percussion instruments in the Miami Philharmonic Orchestra for 12 years before I ever started Results.
Being a musician and working with other musicians provided Sam with insights and skills he brings to his work as an advocate. He highlights important lessons he learned playing in an orchestra.
Preparing, practicing, rehearsing, getting ready. I think there are a lot of advocacy groups that don't do that very well, and that's certainly something that an orchestra would do.
And then the whole area of just working together, playing in unison, and in our case, speaking and acting in unison. I think that's another key piece.
But long before Sam began playing music, there were other factors that shaped him to become the man he is today. His parents planted seeds in him that decades later contributed to his success as an advocate.
Well, my father, who passed away some 25 years ago, was a food manufacturer, mayonnaise, relish, pickles, mustards. My father was very religious, and he would go to synagogue twice a day, morning and evening. And there was a certain persistence, certain stick-to-itiveness, a certain religiosity, I think blossomed in me, that kind of dependability. And my mom, who's still alive and quite active, well, she'll be 101 in June of 2019. There is a certain gentleness and a certain sweetness about her. She had five sisters, all very feisty, and she had a certain other way about her. I think that has fueled a passion for a kind of advocacy that isn't the shouting advocacy, that isn't the blaming and making the other side wrong advocacy. And I would say one other thing. My mom was home every night for dinner, and the only times she wasn't home was then when she worked at the polls at every election. That was the one night that she wasn't there for dinner. And that was another kind of message. Working the polls at election time was important to her.
Sam Daly Harris falls squarely in the role of the advocate, someone working within the system to bring about change. In a moment, you will hear what he has to say about rebels and the wave of protesting we are seeing. But first, I want to introduce you to another rebel, one who is closer to home for me. He is my husband.
My name's Glenn Retief. I was born in Nelspruit, South Africa, in the Mpumalanga region of the country in the northeast.
Not only did Glenn grow up in South Africa, as a boy he lived in Kruger National Park.
Which is a big game reserve, a national park in the northeast of the country about the size of Israel.
Glenn eventually got out of the bush and earned his first university degree in Cape Town, South Africa. In the 1990s, he moved to Florida, and like Sam Daly Harris, loves the warmth of Miami.
Well, Miami is a part of the Caribbean. It's very Caribbean in its culture. It's very Caribbean in its geography. Hurricanes and palm trees and beaches, and you feel close to the sea. And there are lots of very, very low islands. So it's a completely different atmosphere, completely different culture.
Glenn's childhood and young adulthood in South Africa happened at a time of growing turmoil, protests, and violence. He grew up during apartheid.
Well, I'll be pronouncing it apartheid, which is the Afrikaans way of pronouncing it, and that means separateness. So everything was very separate. In the village where I lived, it was defined by law as a white village.
His parents attempted to expose Glenn to the wider world, one that stood opposed to South Africa's racist policies.
My dad used to listen to the BBC and the Voice of America on shortwave. He didn't trust the South African Broadcasting Corporation news. And we subscribed to all these international magazines, Time and National Geographic. And we had foreign exchange students at one point. We had American foreign exchange students visiting from Colorado. So I grew up with a sense that things were different elsewhere in the world and probably better. So I got some of that from my family. Being gay, that I already felt different from and condemned by my culture. So that put some distance between me and other white South Africans. It was somewhat logical to go from that to also being very critical of South Africans' racial attitudes.
At one point, Glenn had to make a crucial choice. As a white male, he was required to sign up for mandatory service in the South African military. It was this military force that violently upheld the institution of apartheid.
Your legal classification was white male. You were obliged to serve for for 4 years in the military, for 2 years of nonstop military service, and then another 2 years of annual camps that were all a month long. If you disobeyed that, you would go to jail for 1.5 times whatever time you refused to serve. So if you refused to serve at all, that would be 6 years in jail.
Many black South Africans and some white South Africans had been protesting in the streets to end the racist policies of the government. Today, we are seeing civil disobedience from groups like Extinction Rebellion, who find inspiration from the anti-apartheid struggle. Looking back, does Glenn see himself as a rebel?
You know, I thought of myself as taking on the role of a rebel because I was quite radical. I considered myself a Marxist. I had a very sort of revolutionary analysis of society. But I think looking back, that's not at all true. If I look at my actual behavior, what I would do is I would go to demonstrations, but I would deliberately sit at the edge of those demonstrations when the police said, you have 10 seconds or 20 seconds to disperse, we're starting to count. You were encouraged to just stay seated. It was nonviolent passive resistance like Gandhi or like Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement in the US. But what I would do is I would sort of wait until 2:10, and then at about 2, I would zip off to the sides, make myself scarce because I didn't want to be beaten up and I didn't want to be arrested. The protests were very violently broken up. They used police dogs, as your listeners have probably seen in footage of the civil rights movement. It was like that, but even more violent. It was shamboks, which were these whips that were used to beat up protesters. And then people were arrested and they were further beaten up, tortured in jail. So you could be detained for a long time without charge at the whims of the police. So I was scared of all of that, and I was not rebellious enough to be one of those that volunteered to be arrested. I naturally gravitated to the role of advocate. I joined an organization called OLGA, Organization for Gay and Lesbian Activism, which was affiliated with the United Democratic Front, which was the broad anti-apartheid organization in South Africa. We tried to mobilize white, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people into the anti-apartheid movement. And likewise, we tried to mobilize the anti-apartheid movement against homophobia and heterosexism and in favor of LGBT rights. And I immediately joined the Constitutional Committee, which was lobbying the liberation movement. Nelson Mandela had just been released and all the other liberation leaders, the liberation movements had just been unbanned. So we were lobbying those groups to include LGBT equality, non-discrimination in the new South African constitution. And I just went right there. I went right to the lobbying and I worked on those documents and I joined meetings and I made phone calls. I felt naturally at home in the role of advocate.
In the role of an advocate, Glenn and a handful of South Africans helped bring about a massive change in national policy.
South Africa became the first country in the world to ban discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation in its 1996 constitution. Shortly after that, the Constitutional Court found that that included gender identity. Every potential discriminatory law or government practice since then has been found unconstitutional by the South African High Court and the Constitutional Court. So legally, there's no anti-LGBT discrimination in South Africa. Socially, there's still plenty of homophobia, heterosexism, transphobia. You can legislate something, but that doesn't change people's social attitudes. But, you know, but the effect on people's legal rights was absolutely enormous.
Much of the work required to bring about this success happened through advocacy.
We would look at drafts of documents and kind of critique the language and critique the arguments. It's funny to me because I've become a college professor and much of what I do is critiquing student writing. But that's what I remember doing is critiquing the writing of my comrades and saying, you know, this argument here I think could be strengthened by adding something about, you know, what ANC liberation leaders have said. But it was a mixture of sending in these documents, writing letters, organizing meetings with the constitutional sort of committees or leaders of these different groups, also coordinating with other groups that were doing similar things to us nationally. It was a lot of meetings and a lot of writing. I felt naturally at home in the role of advocate.
Today, in the USA, Glenn continues his work as an advocate. He co-founded the Susquehanna Valley, Pennsylvania chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby. He's been to Washington, D.C. as a volunteer lobbyist almost every year since 2013. He writes op-eds and letters to the editor. He speaks out about the need to change energy policy so we seriously reduce fossil fuel emissions. In spite of the political climate, Glenn remains hopeful. His hope is grounded in reality. He witnessed the end of apartheid.
Well, Ernest Hemingway, in one of his stories, has a character who goes bankrupt, and another character asks that one, you know, how did this happen? And the answer is, first very slowly, and then very quickly. So I think that that's what it was like with the end of apartheid, is that there were just decades and decades of incredible hard work, incredible sacrifice and suffering, where people were imprisoned, people were tortured, the repression was unbelievable, there were extrajudicial assassinations, there were death squads. Yeah, I had friends who were tortured, who still have injuries today from the torture that they sustained in detention without charge at the hands of the security police. The apartheid states just seemed so invincible. And while all that slow activism was happening, it didn't seem as though that rapid change was ever going to occur. But then it did.
In taking on big systems that need to be changed, we each can play an important role. The roles of rebel and advocate often complement each other. Rebels put pressure on the system through civil disobedience, protests, and other tactics. Advocates play the long game, which requires relationship building while offering concrete solutions. Though he is an advocate, Sam Daly Harris recognizes the important part rebels play.
I mean, I think there's a role for everything except for violence. I don't believe that just left-right working together, cross-partisan, appreciative approach is the approach, and there is no other way. There's no other value to other ways. I don't believe that at all. It's not my way to be the rebel. It's not my way to be the shouter. I mean, the name of my lecture is "Our Shouting and Silence Are Only Two Options." But I think the rebel gets things on the agenda a lot of times. Now, I don't know that the rebel can get it across the finish line. I see the importance of both, and of course, the piece that I feel comfortable embracing.
I don't say it enough. The work you are doing is vital. Whatever part you play in the climate movement is essential. You may be an advocate, a rebel, a helper, or an organizer. You may take on some other role. You are not alone. You are part of a giant movement that is roaring to life and gaining ground. Be strong. Be determined. Look after yourself and each other. And regardless, if you feel hopeful or not, press on. Your work is not in vain. To learn more about Sam Daly Harris and how you can get his book, Reclaiming Our Democracy, just visit the website, reclaimingourdemocracy.com. That's reclaimingourdemocracy.com. To discover more about Glenn Retief's story, you can read his book, The Jack Bank, A Memoir of a South African Childhood. Visit glennretief.com. Retief is spelled like relief, but trade out the L for a T. glennretief.com. Now it is time for the Art House. Elizabeth Dowd is a solo performer who plays Siren Jones in the Mermaid Tear Factory. Elizabeth also helps organize Climakaze Miami,
where artists lead the conversation about climate change and environmental justice. Oftentimes, artists are in a situation where we're looking to the science to legitimize our work and the stories we're making. that we feel we need to be telling the stories that science is telling so that we can be taken seriously with our artwork. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if artists led the conversation? One of the best ways they can do that is by letting the work speak the story.
It is important that Climacazzi takes place in Miami. Elizabeth sees Miami as the city of the future.
It's this portal to the rest of the Americas. It's also this really interesting layering of colonial intersections. So it tells the story of the Americas in a way that I think is really poignant. Mixing of different languages and different cultures from all places via immigration. And sometimes it's immigration through refugeeism, and other times it's migration by choice. So I think that's going to be very, very common in cities all over the world in the future. The mix of languages, Miami is not a city where English is the dominant language usually. So you have the situation where the migration has actually had such a linguistic influence that the language of power is not necessarily English anymore.
There is another way we can see Miami as a futuristic city, a climate model of cities to come.
Very famously, they talk about sea level rise in Miami because I think it's the most dramatic cosmetic thing to point to, but there's this very real situation of saltwater intrusion in the drinking water. And those are, of course, two things that are happening together. That is going to be happening in so many different cities. We just happen to be on the front line right now, but that's going to be happening in places all over. It is happening in New Orleans. It's going to be happening in Boston. And just name it. It's a city of the future, and that it's a case study for how urban environments are going to be dealing with these kinds of problems.
In addition to the collaborative art Elizabeth does in Miami, she also created a solo show she performs in theaters and in public.
This is a project that I've been working on since 2013, I think. I spend a lot of time in Brazil. It's a second home for me. And one of the things that I was confronted with very near to where I live there is a beach that was completely covered in plastic trash. And this is something many people can relate to because they've probably seen images in the media of these, you know, bays or beaches that are covered in plastic detritus that have been amassed through tidal movement and garbage expulsion from a variety of sources. It's this particularly beautiful beach, but it has this layer of plastic. So I started to collect the plastic and think a lot about how to represent that feeling that I have when I'm on that beach looking at all of this plastic. How to represent that theatrically? What story does this tell? How do we create a piece of theater that isn't about lecturing people on recycling or garbage disposal, but that has a protagonist that can speak from the perspective of the sea? I thought about, maybe I could be a stingray. Maybe we can write this from the perspective of a stingray. Or I'm very interested in the octopus intelligence and other larger sea animals.
Elizabeth created and embodies Siren Jones.
She's a vigilante mermaid. She's 382 years old. People often confuse her with Ariel of the Little Mermaid fame. And she takes offense at this, of course, because she is in fact related to Ariel, who's the little sister that made it good in Hollywood. And she decided to take the road of the lonely activist. And so she's out saving the world while her sister is enjoying, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous. She's multilingual. She sells her tears as a, you know, kind of a little bit of a side hustle. But what she's realized is that her tears are actually a very effective anecdote to sadness. You give somebody a little bit of their own of the sickness, and it makes them more resistant.
You will hear more from Elizabeth in future shows. Her reflections about art and climate are deep and insightful. She is pushing the boundaries of what art can do to enrich our climate conversations. And like many people speaking out about climate change, the topic of despair and hope comes up in her work and her reflections.
One of the things I've discovered in this idea of doing the Mermaid Tear Factory is this idea that people will probably reach a moment where they're gonna want to shut down, but if you give them a chance to have a spectrum of emotional responses, including grief, including shock, let them have an opportunity to express despair and anger, and then bring them to a place of creative intention or empowered decision making or connection with a community that cares about the same thing. And I almost avoid using the word hope because I feel like hope is like, oh, it's all going to be fine. And people deep down are suspicious of hope because they're afraid they're going to be proven wrong if they have faith in something and it turns out differently. So the Mermaid Tear Factory is also about the tears, about the fact that we are going to be allowed to mourn losses and talk about those losses, but we're not going to stop there. We're not going to stop there kind of wallowing in our tears per se, but that we're going to be able to say, this is sad, this sucks, this is heartbreaking that we're losing so much of this beauty, but we're going to look each other in the eye and make a decision that we can do better. And that we can figure this out. We can totally figure this out. We're smart.
You can learn more about Elizabeth Dowd by visiting the site climakazemiami.org. That is spelled CLIMAKAZE Miami.org. climakazemiami.org. If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. We've been talking a lot about advocates in this episode. Do you see yourself as an advocate? Why? Our current puzzler question gives you a chance to share some of your own story. Here's the puzzler question. You attended one of the recent student walkout demonstrations. While there, you spoke to a parent, Claire. Claire's daughter was a protest organizer. You tell Claire how you speak to legislators about laws that will address fossil fuel pollution. You see yourself as an advocate, working in the system to bring about change. Claire confesses, "I would never have the patience for that. I'm so angry. I need to protest." She then asks you, "So why do you do that kind of advocacy work instead of protesting and civil disobedience?" Well, why? Send me your answers. Leave your name, contact info, and where you're from. Get back to me by June 15th, 2018. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also text me or leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number, 518-595-9414. Plus one if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 518-595-9414. We've come to the end of episode 36 of Citizens Climate Radio. The show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, Maheen Saeed, Allison Cabisco, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All of the music we use in the show is licensed unless otherwise specified. Please share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Word of mouth helps so much. You can find Citizens Climate Radio wherever you listen to podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/citizensclimateradio. You can follow us on Twitter as well, @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, @CitizensCRadio. And also feel free to tweet at me directly, @P2Sun. That's the letter P, the number 2, S-O-N, @P2Sun. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guest. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.